Good evening. If you have your Bibles, would you open to 1 Corinthians chapter 10? 1 Corinthians chapter 10. We're going to be in 1 Corinthians chapter 10, but we might move around a little bit between chapters 8, 9, and 10 a little bit tonight. These three chapters, 1 Corinthians 8, 9, and 10, I think are a fascinating example of a real-life problem that arose in ancient Corinth, and trying to decipher a scriptural, loving, and God-honoring solution to it. Paul writes with tremendous wisdom as he helps direct and guide the church through a very practical issue, something that they would face and have to answer questions about day to day in their lives. It's the type of issue that at first might seem rather distant and foreign to us, but the more you read it, the more you realize these are the same types of things that we deal with today. I think every culture has these types of things that pop up. So one of the reasons that I want to discuss this passage is because in chapter 10, to connect to our lesson this morning, I briefly made reference to this passage. Paul uses this passage to talk about the children of Israel and their wilderness experience, and that they passed through the sea, or that they were baptized into the sea. You know, when the Red Sea split and they walked through, or they had water all around them, Paul likens that to a baptism for Israel. They left Egypt behind, they went through the water, they passed through, and they went to, well, the wilderness, and then the promised land on the other side of that. But he uses that as part of his scriptural basis for the teaching that he gives regarding this problem that they have. And so this is another one of those scenarios where an issue might arise in your life, and remembering your baptism can help you decipher what should I do here in this situation. So here's the problem. Here's the situation that has arisen in Corinth. And it's not only in Corinth. A lot of these ancient cities that Paul was writing to had to deal with this stuff. And it's the type of thing that would never arise in Jerusalem. You know, the Jews didn't have to deal with this, but Paul, writing to Gentiles, has to deal with this type of thing. Eating meat. Okay. We eat meat all the time, and we don't think much about it, most of us at least. Meat is a very common part of the American diet, and we eat all kinds of meat, and we don't think a lot about whether things are clean or unclean. That might be one of the controversies in a Jewish context, but in a Gentile context, where did this meat come from? How was it cooked? And were there any pagan gods involved? Because here's the deal. We eat meat, and we think of it in terms of like a purely secular, activity. We're just eating. You know, this isn't a religious thing. This is just food. We need it in order to live, right? We need food. And so we think of eating meat. We don't think of anything religious about it sometimes. So perhaps with the Lord's Supper, we think of something religious there. Maybe when we're all dining together, we think of something about fellowship. But many of our meals we just eat, we might say a prayer beforehand, but we don't think of as a sacred moment. Maybe we should more often, by the way, think of our meals as something sacred to help us remember and reflect upon God. But in an ancient culture, there wasn't as clear a distinction between secular and religious like we have. A lot of things were just mixed and mingled together. You had your religious practices that often were a part of just your everyday life. And even if you weren't like fully committed in worship or something like that, just religious practice was the thing you did. It was just part of secular life. And so, for example, eating meat, we might think, well, you just go to the market and buy the meat. But if you're going to cook meat, why not double up and make that also an activity where you're honoring one of the many gods in the city that you live in? That's what they would do. You wouldn't just cook meat without thinking about any god. You would cook meat, and what is cooking meat? Well, it's basically the same thing as a sacrifice. You're putting an animal on fire and you're cooking it. And so what is a sacrifice? Well, they would offer sacrifice to the different gods that overlooked their city. Maybe it was to seek blessing. Maybe it was for Thanksgiving. Maybe it was to honor your city in the future harvest or the weather or something like that. But meat wasn't just cooked for food. It was food, and it was also part of a sacrifice. This also happened in Israel. when you read through Leviticus and you read through the fat sacrifices, the meat sacrifice wasn't just like wasted. It was offered up to God, but then also the priest would get to eat some depending on the sacrifice, and the offerer would get to eat some, and it was kind of like this communal meal where some of the animal was offered up to God and some of it was eaten by the priest and some of it was eaten by the person and the family that offered it, and it was a meal that was shared. That's what sacrifice was. Well, in Judaism, that happened at the temple. In Corinth, that happened in the pagan marketplaces. And so meat would be offered up, and then Christians would think, okay, I want some meat. Is that meat? Like, am I allowed to eat that? I don't believe in that God, and I don't serve that God, but I kind of want this meat. I'm having people over for dinner tonight. What's the rule regarding that? And so, like, every time they got a steak, they had to answer that question. And not everyone had the same answers. So some people just gave up eating that type of meat. And some people did not give up eating that type of meat. And some people thought that it's wrong to eat it. And some people thought, you're crazy to say that it's wrong. You're acting as if that idol's a real thing. And that idol's not a real thing. It's just meat. And they would bicker back and forth. And Paul has to try to sort through some of these things and provide some helpful clarity on how to solve this problem. And like almost every other problem, his solution is, why don't you guys love each other more? That'll really solve a lot of these issues if you guys will just care more about the person next to you. By the way, this is 1 Corinthians 8, 9, and 10. In 1 Corinthians 12 and 13 and 14, he's going to be dealing with some questions regarding spiritual gifts. And there were some people who had the gift of healing. Some people had the gift of prophecy. Some people had the gift of tongues. And it seems like the tongue speakers were acting like they were better than everyone else and putting that as the superior gift. And you know what Paul's solution to that one is? Why don't you guys love each other more? He actually gives the same solution to both of these problems. In fact, one of the most well-known chapters in all of the Bible, 1 Corinthians 13, where Paul describes love in these beautiful and profound terms, that's his solution to their problem with elevating certain gifts and ministries over other gifts and ministries and acting like this is the important one and yours is not as important and I'm great because I do this. He says love is the solution here. Love builds up, even over and above knowledge. By the way, look at chapter 8 and verse 1. Chapter 8 and verse 1, this is how Paul first begins answering this question about meat sacrificed to idols. He says, now concerning things sacrificed to idols, we know that we all have knowledge. Knowledge makes arrogant, but love builds up or edifies. And so right from the very first verse, that's going to be his solution here. If you think, I'm going to really study this thing and I'm going to come to the absolute correct conclusion on it, and I'm going to judge everyone who doesn't come to that conclusion, you may be gaining more knowledge, but that's not actually the solution to the problem here. The solution to the problem here is love. The solution to the problem is not perfect knowledge. That just makes you think, I'm right, and these people are crazy, and it makes you more frustrated with them, and it makes you more arrogant. Paul says, that's not the route to go right now. The route to go right now is to love this person. And so the first thing Paul, real suggestion here is, if it bothers your neighbor, then don't do it. If it causes your neighbor to stumble, then don't do it. If you're in their presence, if you invite them over, don't serve that meat if it's going to be an issue. Paul is one of those who has chosen, he says, not to eat it. Why? Well, it's not because he thinks that it's wrong in and of itself. He says clearly it's not wrong in and of itself. So that's the knowledge answer. But the love answer is, but I love my neighbor even more than that amount of knowledge that I have. And so I'll give up this blessing in order to honor that person. He then, this is chapter 9, talks about how he does that with a lot of things. He gives up rights of his own. He has the right to get paid for ministry, and he is from other places, but he doesn't take it from Corinth because he thinks it would harm his relationship with them. Paul has the right to get married and take on a believing wife. He says right in there, but he hasn't done that. And the reason why is because he thinks he could be of greater service traveling around and putting his life on the line rather than when you get married. You have certain commitments at home that could hinder the type of ministry that he's engaged in. And so there are a number of things that he says, not only have I not eaten meat, like many things in my life, I have given up or changed for the sake of others. In fact, it's in chapter 9 where he talks about, I do all things for the sake of others. He says, to the Jews I've become as a Jew, that I might win the Jews. To those under the law, as under the law. To those without the law, as without the law. I become all things to all people, that by all means I might save some. He says, like, it's not about me demanding my rights. It's not about me demanding to be my authentic self. My authentic self is a servant of Christ, and that will be whatever helps others the most. That's the way that Paul is trying to view this thing. So it's very outward focused, his answer to the problem. Think about what is best for others, and even if it means denying yourself something you like, then deny yourself something you like. At least while they're here, you know, like maybe once they're gone, then you can do something. But while you're in the presence of them, just honor them and respect their wishes, and we can make this thing work. By the time he gets to the end of chapter 10, we come to find out that he has some very specific answers. Certain of them are dealing in different contexts that this problem might arise. For example, if you're going to a pagan temple to have the meal, don't do that. He says, you know what? In Israel, when they had those sacrifices and ate them, they were fellowshipping with the Lord in that moment. When we take the Lord's Supper, we are fellowshipping in that meal with one another and with the Lord. If you go to the pagan temple and you sit there with them in that temple and you have that meal, you are fellowshipping with their gods. And you might say, well, they don't have any gods. And Paul says, actually, you know what a demon is? Paul says, I don't think it's just nothing that those sacrifices are going to. There are demonic forces in this world that are accepting that worship and accepting that praise. And so if you go there and you're a part of it, then you are worshiping and fellowshipping with demons. Don't do that. He tells them very explicitly, chapter 10 and verse 14, therefore, my beloved, flee from idolatry. Like, don't even go near it. Don't get involved in that. However, if you just go to the marketplace and you're buying meat, just buy the meat and don't ask any questions. That's his solution there. He says, don't ask, and for the sake of conscience, just don't ask any questions about it. He says, this is verse 25, eat anything that is sold in the meat market without asking questions for conscience sake. Okay, so just get it and don't make a big fuss about where it came from or anything like that, and just eat it as meat. But then he mentions, verse 27, but what if an unbeliever invites you into their home? Can you eat? He says, yes, eat anything they put in front of you. You can eat it all, that's fine. But if they begin the meal with something like, we want to give thanks to Athena for whom this offering was made, and we want to eat this in her honor, then, as awkward as it may be, you should probably excuse yourself from that meal. Don't sit there and have a meal that you know the meat was sacrificed to this god and engage in that type of setting. And so again, he goes through and he gives some very specific answers to the different questions that arise. But ultimately, these answers are about love, and they are very outward focused. Although there are some answers that are about honoring God and not fellowshipping with demons or with false gods and then still worshiping the God of Israel and kind of like combining those two together. That would be a very big problem. So don't do that. But as for what you're doing in your house or at your neighbor's house or at the unbeliever's house, try to do what best honors them and what best honors God, and that's going to be his answer here. Having said, however, that the answer is outward focused, Paul does actually make a transition at the end of chapter 9 and in chapter 10 about thinking about yourself a little bit too here. Because it's very easy to think, okay, I have this all figured out. I know the right thing to do. I can eat whatever. And okay, I'll love my neighbor and I won't eat in front of them. So I'll just do this thing. I'm strong enough to handle it. They might not be. And so I can handle this. And Paul says, I do want you to stop and think for a minute though. Even about yourself, you might not be as strong as you think you are. You might say, but I've been baptized, but I take the Lord's Supper, you know, with the church. I'm faithful and strong. I understand these things. Take heed, lest you fall. This is where he says that. Let him who thinks he stands, take heed, lest he fall. The person who thinks, well, I can do that and I'll be fine, you should even be careful also. Because sometimes sin has a way of deceiving you and taking you places you never thought you would go. Other people will do that, but not me. Other people will get carried away with addictions. Other people will get carried away with alcohol abuse or drug abuse or spousal abuse or all of these things that sometimes they start with just the smallest things and then they grow and grow. What Paul says is even you need to be careful with those things to make sure this stuff doesn't get out of control. And so Paul, after talking about how focused he is towards outsiders, he says, notice in verse 25 through 27 of chapter 9. So right at the end of chapter 9, he says, everyone who competes in the games exercises self-control in all things. He's using an example of an athlete. And by the way, the games in Corinth would have been very specific games called the Isthmian Games. They met every 2 years. Corinth was a big place for these athletic games in ancient Greece. And he says, everyone who competes in the games, they exercise self-control in all things. They then do it to receive a perishable wreath. But we... imperishable. So they get this wreath that goes around the head, but after years, the wreath is molding and dying and wilting. He says, that's what they get. We, however, get a wreath that endures forever and ever. So take the race seriously. Verse 26, he says, therefore, I run in such a way as not without aim. I box in such a way as not beating the air. And I discipline my body and I make it my slave so that after I have preached to others, after I've been outward focused, I myself will not be disqualified. He says, so even though I preach to others, I want others to hear the gospel, I want to make myself a servant of others, I have to work on myself daily to make sure that I'm not just running the race without aim and without direction or boxing without an opponent. I need to make sure that what I'm doing has purpose and that I am exercising self-control in my own life so that I don't spend all of my faithfulness working towards others while I am dying spiritually and I myself even become disqualified. So then when you get to chapter 10, having just mentioned the very possibility of even Paul becoming disqualified, he says, now I want you guys to think about yourself. And I'm going to take you through a Bible story. He's going to go back to the book of Exodus and the book of Numbers in particular. And he's going to say, I want you to look at Israel and see what they've done and see how you fit into this story. And this is where the topic of baptism is going to come up. This is where he's going to make that connection between the lives of the Christians at Corinth and the lives of those Israelites who had escaped Egypt and went into the wilderness, passing through the Red Sea. And he says, they are people who you might have thought would stand, right? Imagine every morning you wake up and just a meal from God floats down to you to eat. You might have trust in God, right? Imagine the Red Sea split right in front of you. People talk like that. Like, I've heard many classes. In fact, I feel that way sometimes. Like, man, if I could see some of the things that they saw, surely that would bolster my faith and I would be even more convicted, you know? Well, not necessarily. And that's what Paul's going to be saying here. He says, look at what they had and what did they do? Many of them who were not careful, they fell. Make sure that you don't follow in that same example. So he's going to use Israel as an example of you need to make sure that you don't get so arrogant in thinking, oh, I could eat whatever I want, go to any pagan temple, I can be around idolatry and it'll never get to me. Be careful, it very well may. So chapter 10 and verse 1, Paul says, but I do not want you to be ignorant or unaware, brethren, that our fathers... So this is the Israelite forefathers, and it is interesting, writing to a Gentile audience, that he refers to them as our fathers. These Gentiles have been adopted into the family of Israel, and he can refer to the Israelite ancestors in the book of Exodus as our fathers. But he says that our fathers were all under the cloud and all passed through the sea. They were all baptized into Moses in the cloud and in the sea. So that cloud that they followed, the sea that they passed through, he says that was like a baptism. And they were baptized into Moses. So we are baptized into Christ in the waters. But he says, but they had something like that. They had baptism. So don't be thinking, oh, I've been baptized, and so I have everything under control. I have spiritual superiority now, and I have nothing to be concerned about. You should never boast in your baptism. He says they had a baptism, And let's see how much good it did for them. Also, verse 3, he says, they were baptized in Moses in the cloud and the sea, and all ate the same spiritual food, and all drank the same spiritual drink. Now notice, ate and drank. Those are really important because that's what he's talking about context-wise. He's talking about eating and drinking food sacrificed to idols. He says they ate and drank the spiritual food. I think he's talking about the manna that came from heaven and the water that came from the rock that they continually drank. And he says they drank the same spiritual food, for they were drinking from a spiritual rock which was following them. And then notice this, and the rock was Christ. So he's saying they had baptism. They had spiritual food and drink, kind of like we have with the Lord's Supper. They even had Christ following them. He uses some views about that ancient rock to teach something that's kind of interesting. And there's a lot you can get into with that phrase right now, which we're not going to. But Paul is using that rock as a way of saying the source of life that followed them through the wilderness was Christ himself. And he says, so that's what they had. If you have baptism, the Lord's Supper, and Christ, you're going to think you can withstand anything, right? Well, keep reading. Verse 5. Nevertheless, with most of them, God was not pleased, for they were laid low in the wilderness. Even though they had all of that, when they got to the wilderness, problem after problem arose. He's going to start detailing. This is basically the Exodus in Numbers, a brief summary of it, and it's all bad. Verse 6. Now these things happened as examples for us, so that we would not crave evil things as they also craved. So this what you're reading when you read Exodus and Numbers is your own example, so that you don't crave the types of things that they craved. Verse 7. Do not be idolaters, as some of them were. As it is written, the people sat down to eat and drink and stood up to play. Eating and drinking, that's the food sacrificed to idols. You know where that's a quotation right there when he says, it is written, the people sat down to eat and drink and stood up to play. That's from Exodus 32 and verse 6. That is when Moses went back up on the mountain and the children of Israel, there at the bottom, they made that golden calf. And Aaron put all their gold together, made it. And what did they do? They sat down to eat and drink a meal with that calf. And they stood up to play. They danced. They had music. They worshiped this calf as their God. So even though they had God, who just overthrew the Egyptians, who gives them a meal every day in the wilderness, who has split the Red Sea, and they've seen all of that, they still, as soon as they got around the idol, they started eating and drinking with the idol. They started playing with the idol. They gave their allegiance to the idol. And so, verse 7 is an example of, if you think you can go to that temple and not be impacted, think about them. Like, they were right there at the base of Mount Sinai. They could see the cloud on the top of it. And yet they gave in. Be careful. He says in verse 8, nor let us act immorally as some of them did. And 23,000 fell in one day. That's probably a reference to Numbers 25 when they're at the plain of Moab and they've made it through the wilderness basically and they're about to enter the promised land. But while they're there, they begin worshiping false gods, worshiping the gods of the Moabites and worshiping Baal. And while there, they also start engaging in sexual immorality. They start sleeping with the Moabite women. In fact, there's one guy who brazenly, even in the face of punishment from God, walks with a Moabite woman into his tent in the presence of all. They both end up being killed. But at that time, a plague broke out, and there was massive loss of life. He mentions here 23,000 in one day fell. And so you have that scene right there. Think of everything they had seen and experienced, and yet that's what they did. Be careful. Verse 9, nor let us try the Lord, as some of them did, and they were destroyed by the serpents. So this is when they start complaining again about the food and the water. It's actually an interesting passage in Numbers 21 where they say, we have no food, we have no water, and we hate this food. And it's kind of funny to say, we have no food and we hate this food. Sometimes in the wilderness, your mind can play tricks on you and you see things as even worse than they are. They do have food. It was a gift from God every day, but it became something common and something that they even despised because they wanted other things. If you have a God-given meal every day, even that can turn you against the Lord. And they said, let's go back to Egypt. And guess what happened? That's when the snakes come out. Remember the story of the venomous serpents in the wilderness, and Moses makes the bronze serpent and he holds it up. And when they look at that, even though they are being bitten, the venom will not harm them. Well, that's what happened there. So there was a way of salvation through it. Yet, we have an example of the children of Israel rejecting the food that God has given them and rejecting God himself. Verse 10, the next story, he says, nor grumble as some of them did, and they were destroyed by the destroyer. It's harder to know exactly what passage he's talking about there because they grumbled a lot. They grumbled in Exodus, in the teen chapters there. They grumbled again throughout Numbers, and there was judgment that came again because of that. So, what can we learn from this? People who had baptism, people who had spiritual food and drink given to them miraculously by God, people who had Christ following them in some allegorical or spiritual way, people who had seen incredible miracles, even they fell in the face of idolatry that was all around them. So verse 11, now these things happened to them as an example, and they were written for our instruction, upon whom the ends of the ages have come. Therefore, let him who thinks he stands be careful. Take caution, take heed, that he does not fall. No temptation has overtaken you, but such is common to man. So you might think, well, they had their temptations. This temptation's unique. Well, he's saying they had those same temptations back then. You have these temptations now. You're not experiencing anything new and unique. And you can learn from those who have experienced these temptations before. Even though you would think that they would stand, certainly, having seen the plagues of Egypt and witnessed God's mighty arm deliver them, you would have thought that they would stand, yet they didn't. So he says that make sure that you don't fall in that same trap. But God, this is verse 13, is faithful, who will not allow you to be tempted beyond what you are able, but with the temptation will provide a way of escape also, so that you may be able to endure it. That's a wonderful verse, but I do think sometimes we can read it and we can think, okay, so now I need to find this way of escape. What is the way of escape in this temptation? And often the way of escape is escape. Just don't go. Like, what's the way of escape from the pagan temple? Don't go to it. Flee it. Sometimes the way of escape is pretty easy. That's the next verse. Therefore, my beloved, flee from idolatry. That's the way of escape. Don't go to the idols. Don't go to the temples. Don't go and sit around with a bunch of pagans and give thanks to this pagan god for this food that you have before you. That's going to be a real temptation. That's going to be like, well, I know I shouldn't, but it's really awkward if I get up and leave now. And so you're kind of tempted to sit there and just go through it. And Paul's saying, just get away from it. Don't even flirt with idolatry. By the way, it's the same thing he says a few chapters earlier about sexual immorality. Just flee from it. Don't even go to the temple where there's the temple prostitutes and things like that. Just ignore all of that stuff and have a community where you could be one with one another without depending on those other pagan things. And if you can do that, you can escape and flee from those things. That's the way of temptation. So having said all of that, Paul then makes some of his very practical points about not going to the temple, not asking questions, and if you're at someone's house and they start honoring the other god, well, then you probably ought to leave. But first and foremost, with respect to what you're going to do, think about your neighbor, choose love, and honor them with your decisions, honor God with your decisions, and remember that you're not as strong as you think you are. So baptism is an important part of this conversation because baptism is one of those things that could theoretically prop us up into thinking, yeah, but I'm strong enough to handle this. I've done all the spiritual acts that God has required. I've had my sin. I've had my life transformed. I've had my old man killed and my new man, and I'm surely more. I'm strong enough to endure anything that can come my way. And Paul is saying, not so fast. you should be careful each and every day. Even Paul has to discipline his own body daily so that he himself will not become disqualified. So the encouragement is, if you have been baptized, wonderful, praise God, rejoice in that, but also every day strive to be faithful, to be committed, to remember that decision that you made, and never become so arrogant or proud as to think that you can't fall prey to the vices of Satan as well. If there's anyone here who perhaps in your life you have been drifting away, perhaps you have been putting other things above God, we'd love to help encourage you and pray for you in any way that we can. If you have the need, please come and sit on the front row while we stand and as we sing.